Hey there, it's Tom Switzer and welcome to Between the Lines on RN. In case you've missed the news, Japan no longer has a pacifist constitution. Since World War II, Japan could only take up arms if the country was attacked. Well, from now on, though, Japan can fight overseas even if it is not directly threatened. It's a new chapter in Asian geopolitics. It's big news that hasn't attracted much attention in Australia, that is, until now. Stay with us for my chat with Gregory Clark. Plus, we've heard a lot about Peter Credlin recently. She was Tony Abbott's former right-hand woman. But what precisely is the role of the Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister? We'll hear soon from a political scientist who's written a book about the subject. Remember Lee Kuan Yew's famous quip about Japan? Allowing Tokyo to send troops abroad, Lee remarked, is akin to feeding a reformed alcoholic chocolate liqueurs. Well, one wonders what Singapore's founding father would think today. In recent weeks, the Japanese government has changed its pacifist constitution. Since World War II, Japan could only take up arms if the country was attacked. But at a time when China is flexing its military muscles in the region, the pacifist constitution has left Japan vulnerable, or so says Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And it's why Tokyo's defence posture has changed. Now, Japan's military, known as the Self-Defence Forces, that can fight overseas for the first time since the 1940s, even if Japan is not directly threatened. Now, here to talk about all of this is probably Australia's longest Japan watcher. Gregory Clark worked for the Department of External Affairs in the 50s and 60s. He was the first official to be trained in Chinese after the Communist Revolution of 1949, even before Kevin Rudd. And he's lived in Japan for the past four decades, where he has been, among other things, president of Tama University in Tokyo. Gregory Clark, welcome back to the ABC.
Thank you very much.
Now, this has been a historic shift for the nation that once set its sights on invading Australia. How exactly does this new law reinterpret Japan's constitution?
Well, it turns it upside down rather than reinterpret. The words in the constitution is that the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as a means of settling international disputes. Well, this change in policy means that they do claim the right to get involved in wars, even if it's only, as they claim, in support of their allies. But their allies having wars in Iraq, having wars in Vietnam, and that allows Japan to get involved. Not a very pleasant prospect.
Well, let's take a hypothetical situation. I mean, with this overhauling of the constitution, how would Japan act differently than it would act if the constitution were to still be interpreted in the more pacifist way?
Well, the way it acted right through the 60s and 70s, Japan then was a very attractive society, at least as far as I was concerned. I mean, they had a military which was used mainly for disaster control and so on, domestically. And the overwhelming feeling in the nation was pacifist. It just did not like wars. And that was a Japan that I liked.
Well, Prime Minister Abe and the parliament have made these changes despite some strong opposition in Japan. Why? Why is it so important to Abe?
Well, it's a difficult one. The Japanese, certainly the older generations, are rather conservative and do like the idea of having a strong army. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty, like, well, where would they fight? What would we do if some of our people were killed and so on? Then they tend to back off. Surprisingly, the younger Japanese are fairly supportive, some of them anyway. It's a mixed bag at the moment. They can't make up their mind.
Tell us about Abe's grandfather and whether you detect any similarities between the two.
Oh, there's a very important connection, yes. That the grandfather, Kishi Nobusuke, was one of the architects of the last war, the war against America and Australia. And he would have been condemned as a war criminal, but for later on, America intervened and these people were let free. He then set out to tie Japan's military to the United States, and Abe Shinzo follows that tradition. Very significant was that as soon as he got the legislation that he wanted, to be honest, the legislation was watered down quite a lot, mainly because of the influence of the pacifist partner in his coalition, the so-called Kōmeitō, But as soon as Abe got his legislation, he went and made a report to the grave of his grandfather.
Well, that's interesting. One thing you haven't mentioned, Gregory, is the role of China here. I mean, it's assertive conduct in recent years. Surely that's played a role in shaping Abe's thinking about Japanese defence.
I think you need to change the wording of that. Mr. Abe has been shaping China as a threat to the nation. The whole thing has been blown up. The threat over the so-called Senkaku Islands, it's quite clear that if anyone is in the wrong, it's Japan, not China. The Chinese were angry, and when they get angry, they do tend to make it quite clear. And as a result of their anger, the situation has gone back to what it was originally before Japan disturbed it. The situation was the whole dispute should be shelved, and we're now back to shelve. The Chinese have done nothing to threaten that situation. The Chinese have been very good about accepting the Japanese borderline in the East China Sea. Australia, actually, in discussions with East Timor, used the continental shelf as the borderline, largely. And if China used the continental shelf, then the borderline would come very close to Japan, would come over towards Okinawa. The other international standard is the median line, halfway between the two countries. Of course, and that, needless to say, the Japanese insist on that. And the Chinese have been very good and said, all right, if that's what you want, we accept it. The Chinese, on the contrary, have been very cooperative. Of course, in the South China Sea, we have the situation that you know, and I think everyone knows, that the Chinese have been taking these uninhabited islands or rocks and shoals. Well, you can call it militarization, but filling them up.
Admiral Harry Harris of the US Pacific Fleet says China's building a great wall of sand.
But it hasn't touched anybody else's claims in that area. A lot of other people are claiming islands, and they got in earlier, before China. The fact is, I wish the Chinese would emphasize this more, when the war ended, Japan had to sign a peace treaty with China in those days, the nationalist China of Chiang Kai-shek. And that says specifically that Japan renounces to China all rights to the Spratlys and the Paracels, precisely the islands which are now being disputed. China, on the basis of that treaty, could claim every one of those islands. It was nationalist China which invented the nine-dash line, which said that the whole of the South China Sea belonged to China. We all supported nationalist China. Nobody then made a protest, contested that claim. They then, after the war, during China's period of weakness, they moved in. The Vietnamese took some islands. The Philippines tried to take some. Taiwan took some and developed. The Chinese haven't challenged what they've done, but they've just revived the claim that, and I might add, that treaty, that peace treaty with nationalist China, was written by the Americans. So they should know about it and they should remember it.
What then do you make of Abe's call for Japan to be a permanent member of the UN Security Council?
I go along with it so long as the other contenders like Brazil and India and Germany are considered, because the Security Council has become the monopoly of Russia and America. I think in any redesign of the Security Council, this right that has been abused will be rewritten, and in order to, how should I say, look, there'll be a new form of veto. Maybe they have to have two or three, or they have a vote or something like that. But the idea that one nation can prevent any action by the United Nations is clearly out of date.
If you've just joined us, you're on RN's Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer, and I'm chatting with Gregory Clark. He's our longest and best qualified Japan watcher. Gregory, let's talk about Japan's economy. It remains sluggish. It can't escape deflation. It's at the risk of falling into its second recession in 2 years. Question, what are the prospects of free market structure reforms that could possibly kickstart the economy?
The Japanese market is free market as you could want. There are bureaucratic problems which exist in all economies. The problem with Japan is a chronic lack of domestic demand. And in fact, this is increasingly a problem in the European economies. In other words, excessive savings. And the way around it is for the government to mobilize those savings and spend much more money on infrastructure and expand demand that way. They've taken a temporary measure of deflating the value of the currency, of the yen. But that is not a very healthy way to boost an economy. Infrastructure investment is the answer.
Yeah, well, I suppose that lack of domestic demand that you mentioned, that's been compounded by demographic challenges. And, of course, Japan's debt, I think the debt-to-GDP ratio is something like 250%.
Well, I don't know what school of economics you adhere to, but there is one very persuasive school that says government debt is not a problem so long as the debt is held by the government. Mm. In other words, governments have the right to put out money if it is needed to expand demand.
Or as John Maynard Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead, right?
No, there are some very serious economists who are trying to get this understanding through. And, of course, Japan at the moment is going the other direction of trying to curb demand by increasing taxes.
Now, the big news this month, Gregory, has been the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is a 12-nation free trade deal that includes Australia, the United States, Japan, and nine other Pacific Rim nations. To what extent do you think this TPP will reform Japan's closed industries? I'm thinking most notably of automobiles and agriculture.
Well, this has been going on for some time, liberalisation of trade, and Japanese agriculture is a major victim of the liberalisation. There'll be a further reduction in tariffs, and the consumers here will get their rice and their meat a little bit more cheaply. I don't think it'll make a very big difference. Automobiles are significant in that the Japanese want to maintain exports of automobile parts, and the TPP could restrict that to some extent. In other words, for example, cars imported into the United States, say from Mexico, they're not allowed in if they have a very high proportion of parts, say from Japan. But otherwise, it doesn't really make all that much difference.
Mm. Finally, Gregory, let's turn to the nature of relations between Australia and Japan. Now, Tony Abbott had formed a close and productive relationship with Abe. I think he even went so far as to say in 2013 that Japan was, quote, Australia's closest friend. Now, Australia is one of many nations looking to upgrade its submarine fleet, and it's in discussions right now with Japan. It's already got intelligence and technology sharing deals. Question, should our two nations upgrade the relationship to a fully fledged alliance?
Well, China didn't exist. We can do whatever we like. But this is all antagonizing China, and that is a very unhealthy situation. Mm. I very much welcome the remark by the new Prime Minister, Turnbull, where he said, listen, remember that China was the nation that helped to defend us in the last war, not just America, that we've got to take China a lot more seriously than we do. Japan wants to militarize. It's invented a China threat. And it's not just China. They've managed to persuade themselves that North Korea is a threat too. If we want to go along with this sort of nonsense, I don't think it's very healthy.
Yeah, but I mean, in fairness, it's not just Abe and perhaps Abbott talking this language. It's many other states in the region who are uneasy, indeed alarmed by China's posturing. Malaysia, the Philippines, an old Cold War foe of America, clamouring for US security guarantees. But you take a fairly benign view of China's rise.
No, I understand. China's rise is just going to go on for a long time. It's going to be overwhelming. And at the moment it's peaceful, but it could change. And I think the Asian nations are right to allow for that possibility that things will change, and on that basis seek to have some connection with America and so on, and with Japan to maintain a balance. But if in the protests they antagonize China, then of course we get a reverse situation that they bring on the danger that they're claiming to be afraid of.
Gregory, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much for being on Between the Lines.
Yes, Tom, thank you very much. I've enjoyed the talk.
Via Skype, that was Gregory Clark, an Australian academic who's been based in Tokyo for four decades.
This is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Well, if you've paid close attention to federal politics in recent times, you'll be familiar with the name Peta Credlin. Now, she was the controversial chief of staff to former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, widely praised for her role in Abbott's victory in 2013. She was also widely blamed for Abbott's downfall last month. Not surprisingly, the role of the chief of staff in the Prime Minister's office has come under scrutiny. So what is the role of the PM's right-hand man or woman? how do things really work at the centre of our governing networks? And what distinguishes Credlin from her predecessors? For answers, let's chat with Anne Tiernan. She is co-author of The Gatekeepers, Lessons from Prime Ministers, Chiefs of Staff. It's published by the Melbourne University Press. She's also Professor of Government and International Relations at Griffith University in Brisbane. Anne, welcome to Between the Lines.
G'day, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Lovely to have you here. Now, why did you decide to write a book on this subject?
Most of my research is focused on the work of governing. That's what I'm really interested in. And in the course of some earlier research I did on the development and evolution of ministerial staffing arrangements, I came into contact with the presidential studies literature. Mm-hmm. And in the US, there's a long tradition, actually, of examining the role of the people who work for the President of the United States. And it's seen as an important contribution to the institutional memory of an organisation that disbands every 4 or 8 years, depending on the electoral cycle. So I was very interested, given the turnover and the, you know, what I'd call the hybridisation of the Prime Minister's advisory arrangements between public service departments and a growing number of staff, whether we could bring that methodology that had been tried twice in the US to
here. So the role model here is America. What about the chiefs of staff in number 10 in Britain?
Yeah, well, of course, that role is much more recent, and the public service or the civil service in the UK has been much more successful in keeping special advisers to a minimum. Uh-huh. In Australia, this role has a 40-year institutional history, and of course, prime ministers have always had senior advisers, but they tended generally to come from the bureaucracy.
Well, the former chiefs of staff that you've interviewed, they use metaphors such as gatekeeper, javelin catcher, shock absorber, pest controller, and Dr. No to describe the role.
Yeah, well, the javelin catcher is the kind of the term that the Americans use to characterise the role. So I had 11 former chiefs of staff together to talk about the role. We had people who'd held the job from Fraser through to Rudd in two workshop sessions and using interpretive political science methods that I won't go into now. Mm-hmm. We were interested in how they understood the development and evolution of the role.
And I suppose above all else, a chief of staff needs a very close relationship with the Prime Minister. You quote David Kemp, quote, "I think you have to be completely frank with the PM. You don't keep anything back. If people tell you something or know something, you should always be prepared to tell the PM what that was so he can factor it into his discussion."
Yeah, absolutely. And this is an important point. All of them have enjoyed very strong relationships of loyalty and trust to the Prime Minister. That's the critical thing, is the fit with the Prime Minister's style. And this is where this beautiful Australian metaphor of, well, you know, if the Americans have got javelin catcher, how could we understand that here? And Jeff Walsh, who had worked in the Hawke office but later became Keating's chief of staff, coined this beautiful phrase of, you know, well, on the one hand, you're the pest controller. You're keeping people away, you know, who might take up the Prime Minister's time or not be very useful, oftentimes their colleagues. And you also have to be the shock absorber. So you're giving the Prime Minister some news he or she might not want to hear. It's really only with you that they can be safe in, you know, going berserk, you know, under relentless pressure. On the other hand, you've got to be the shock absorber for the people who aren't brave enough to take on the leader. So the Chief of Staff wears a fair bit of opprobrium. And I think we've seen that with most of the Chief of Staff, not least Peter Credlin.
Indeed. You talk about pest control. What about pests in the media? I mean, surely the relationship between the Chief of Staff and the Prime Minister's office on the one hand, and the Fourth Estate has changed dramatically over this period you cover.
Yeah, well, I mean, the role has very much changed. And, you know, in the book, we're very much focused on the role of Chief of Staff. But within most successful governments, that personal staffing cohort has comprised, you know, several senior people. The Chief of Staff is the sort of the central nexus, responsible for running the office and, you know, advice. Depending on their mix of skills, they might spend more or less time interested in issues management. But I think in terms of the media relationship, generally there's been a senior press secretary. And I would observe under the sort of the Rudd, Gillard and Abbott governments, the Chiefs of Staff have seemed to take a lot more of this kind of responsibility for the relationship with the media, or the media have become kind of West Wing obsessed with the role of the Chief of Staff.
Yeah,
so
sure.
So I think this celebrity, you know, for want of a better word, that has been drawn around the Chief of Staff is a more modern phenomenon. And the ones in our sample were quite uncomfortable with that development. These are people who are supposed to be in the background. But the journalists in Parliament House have become deeply fascinated with Alistair Jordan, you know, Ben Hubbard, who worked for Gillard, and also, of course, you know, famously Peter Credlin.
Now, you cover a 40-year period. What about the move to the new Parliament House in 1988? To what extent did that change the geography of power?
Yeah, well, the geography of power is critical, and the move to new Parliament House in 1988 really changed the spatial dynamics of the relationship. So on the one hand, in the past, in that old and funny cramped building that you can sort of visit when you go to Canberra, you can see how informal it was. Sandy Holway, who was Hawke's chief of staff and who oversaw the relocation, said, look, you know, it was a shocking work environment. It was impossible for anybody to do anything with people, you know, wandering in and out. Next time you're there, Tom, have a look. They told us a story about how they drilled a hole, a peephole, in the bookcase so that they could see if the Prime Minister needed rescuing from any of his colleagues. Of course, now that's all done by a quite sophisticated video arrangement.
And now, of course, they can employ much bigger staff.
They can employ much bigger staff. Yeah. And that's one of the features of the new Parliament House. But the other one is the extraordinary distance and insularity, I guess, of that ministerial wing. But, you know, interestingly, in the research, the Chiefs of Staff talked about how important Malcolm Fraser was, and his psychology was imprinted on the Chief of Staff and Prime Minister's office role by virtue of the design decisions that were taken in the wake of the Hilton Hotel bombing here in Sydney.
Wow.
So quite interesting, the view that was had. But of course, that space, you know, led to an expansion, but it also led to a growing distance between the Prime Minister's court and then the traditionally more close relationship with the public service.
If you've just joined us, you're on RN's Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer, chatting with Professor Anne Tiernan, co-author of The Gatekeepers, Lessons from Prime Ministers, Chiefs of Staff, and Adrenaline and Stress. The decision-making under stress, it often produces an adrenaline high.
Mm.
And, of course, for many senior politicians, it's addictive to such an extent that they miss it when they leave office.
Yeah.
But it also must be tough for chiefs of staff because they have to worry about their own stress levels but also their own prime ministers.
Yeah, exactly right. And this is something that they talked about at length, and they talked about the importance of managing, you know, the office of Prime Minister, but also the person who holds the office, and rest and recreation and allowing PMs to do something that they enjoy doing, just to give them some respite, is a really important part of the role as well. So, you know, it is really quite a close thing, observing someone, managing the family, doing some of these other things. Lots of them talked about how at Christmas time they'd all get incredibly sick. You know, they'd take time off and the, you know, just their body would kind of give out. Arthur Sinodinos, actually, who did the job for 9 years and, you know, is... and is very much seen as sort of the gold standard of Prime Minister's Chiefs of Staff, including by the cohort of people in this sample. He said that it felt like getting out of prison when he left the job in December 2006 because it's just so relentless.
Indeed.
So lots of them are concerned about the intensification of that job and the pressure on that job and whether it means that increasingly either people are only going to be able to do it for a short period of time, although Peter Credlin effectively held that job for 5 years from opposition and into government, much more intense in government. But maybe that means only young people can do it.
Well, you talk about young people and stress. What about Alistair Jordan? He was Kevin Rudd's chief of staff. Now, he was awfully young, probably the youngest chief of staff.
Yeah, this is a common myth about Alistair Jordan, that he was the youngest ever prime minister's chief of staff. And I think that's because all the people who'd been around when the really youngest chief of staff, who was Jim Spiegelman.
Is that a fact?
That is a fact.
The ABC chairman under Whitlam, right?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of the Whitlam era. All his contemporaries were sort of so much older by then. So by the time the people who were their age, it's sort of a baby boomer phenomenon, don't you think, Tom? Where, you know, oh, nobody's got that experience now. So Alistair was significantly verbaled on his age. He was, in fact, the second youngest.
Right, but you quote Kevin Rudd saying that, and he praises Jordan, he'd been with him in opposition as well, a few grey beards, this is Kevin Rudd, would have helped around the place, helping with institutional wisdom for keeping open lines of communication. Well, how right he was, because Jordan, on the day of Kevin Rudd's knifing in June 2010, apparently had leaked something to the papers that day, and there was a huge storm that ultimately led to Rudd's downfall that night.
Yeah, there was a story that Jordan had tested Gillard's loyalty and was checking, you know, whether she was still loyal to the PM. And this illustrates a really important lesson that the Chiefs of Staff talked about. You really have to be an honest broker. You are part of the politics, you know, and of course you're defending the leader and you're supporting the leader, but you really do have to be careful in those trust relationships. So that was seen as an extraordinary breach of trust.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, there's one person who's responsible for how the Chief of Staff behaves, and it's the Prime Minister who sets the kind of framework.
Yeah. Peter Credlin. Now, following the Liberal leadership spill in February, former Labor leader Mark Latham wrote, quote, "The Liberal jihad against Credlin, supported by journalists and cartoonists, is one of the worst things I have witnessed in public life." Latham goes on to say, "Credlin has become a more popular subject of conservative attack than Labor and the Greens."
Yeah, fascinating observation, and one that sort of hints at, you know, a point that the Prime Minister himself raised about, you know, whether Credlin was attracting criticism because she was a woman.
Let's just hear from the then Prime Minister about misogyny. Here he is at the height of the controversy surrounding his Chief of Staff earlier this year.
Do you really think, Lyndall, that my Chief of Staff would be under this kind of criticism if her name was P-E-T-E-R? As opposed to PETA.
That's a message to your colleagues, isn't it? Because well, that's where the criticism's coming
from. Well, look, Lyndall, as I said, I think people need to take a long, hard look at themselves with some of these criticisms.
Tony Abbott on sexist attacks against his Chief of Staff, and any truth to Abbott's argument?
Look, there have only ever been three women to hold the Chief of Staff position, and all of them have had short, difficult tenures in the role. Credlin probably the most successful in the job. But clearly she was a figure who was seen by elected ministers as exercising more than delegated power. A bit like Julia Gillard said, gender wasn't the only thing, but wasn't not relevant. So I think, there was a big story around Peter Credlin, and she obviously had a divisive style. But Abbott was the author of that in many ways, and this needs to be remembered. Mm-hmm. He did something very unusual in terms of his Chief of Staff, constantly describing her as the boss, as the fiercest political warrior that he'd ever known. And this was something that John Howard would never have done. And to me, Tom, this is one of the really intriguing things that's not covered in our study, but it's probably something that I want to look at in the future, is the issue of institutional memory really matters, the capacity to learn lessons from what went before. That's why we did this book, so that there'd be some available to incoming chiefs of staff. But why, when institutional memory was available to the Abbott cohort, did they deliberately not learn lessons from it? And I think that's one of the most intriguing kind of questions about his leadership and the Prime Minister's office.
It's a fair point, but getting back to Latham's argument, I mean, there used to be a convention in Australian politics that staff were exempt from public criticism, right? I mean, politicians had to take responsibility for mistakes, and it's a bit unfair to attack the staff. After all, they have no right of reply.
Yeah, and that's been the tradition, that they have no right of reply. And, of course, an attack on the Chief of Staff is a proxy for an attack on the leader, because there's deep, dissatisfaction, and they're the shock absorber. I think in this case, Credlin has had a right of reply, and that's what's fascinating about this development, because usually the chiefs of staff go, that we haven't had the tradition of writing books here in Australia. That's developing among our political class more generally. But certainly chiefs of staff hadn't done it. Now, she, in the couple of weeks after the demise, says, well, look, actually, this really was a sexist issue. And had I been a man, I would have been seen as strong and not pushy or bossy. I think the point is that she was a very visible chief of staff. And, in the US, the same thing is true. When a chief of staff is seen as being too strong, as stepping over that line where elected politicians think is more appropriately theirs, they really take umbrage at it and they won't cop it.
Anne, thanks so much for being on Between the Lines today.
Oh, pleasure, Tom.
That was Anne Tiernan. She's co-author of The Gatekeepers, Lessons from Prime Ministers, Chiefs of Staff. Well, I had the pleasure of speaking at the annual conference of the Australian Institute of International Affairs in Canberra this week. Other speakers included the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, and the Shadow Foreign Minister, Tanya Plibersek. Now, Bishop was a geopolitical big picture overview. Plibersek highlighted the security threats posed by climate change. And that's something former Labor Foreign Minister Gareth Evans dismissed at the same conference. Now, both speeches lead this week's recommended list on our website. Remember, you can also follow our recommendations on Facebook or on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is RNSwitzerLines. Well, that's all for this week's edition of Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Let's speak next week.